former petitioner, Mr. Russell Payne, for argument purposes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Russell McMaines, co-counsel for the petitioner Farrekah S.A. In this lawsuit, which I believe is fairly simple and in keeping with the court's kindness in advancing the argument for counsel's personal purposes, I will attempt to make my remarks as brief as possible, as not to further encumber the court's obviously otherwise vacant docket. This is a case that very simply involves a question virtually solely of law from the standpoint of the only argument that has been made and bought by the El Paso Court of Appeals that resulted in the reversal and rendition of a trial court judgment based on a jury verdict. That point is simply a question as to whether or not the failure to reduce an already otherwise complete contractual document that had been initialed and approved by both of the parties to the agreement into a more formal legal instrument somehow meant that as a matter of law, simply no questions of fact existed that could be submitted to the jury that would establish and raise the issue of the intention of the parties to be legally bound to a buy-sell agreement, which in fact our contention and the court's instructions indicated was controlled by the UCC or impacted by the Uniform Commercial Code with regards to what those fact issues are. Those fact issues as submitted to the jury were simply whether or not they had entered into an agreement to buy and sell with the applicable terms for a particular specified price. We're dealing with six rather expensive amusement park rides for a location in El Paso at an amusement park that was owned and be operated by the GRD Development Company. The negotiations took place over a period from September to October and culminated in instruments signed and initialed by both parties in October, which neither side has ever contended was ambiguous on its face. The question is not the construction of the instrument. The question is the formation of the contract. And as to the question of the formation of the contract, as we have articulated in our briefing, as the commentators generally write, Corbin in Section 30, the restatement in Section 33, and the Court of Appeals' rather extensive discussion that we have alluded to, ironically enough, the other side's position in Texaco versus Pennzoil, the question really is one of the intention of the parties to create a legally binding obligation, even though there may be a contemplation that there will be a reduction to a more formalistic writing in the future. And the commentators and the UCC make it very clear that the mere fact that the parties contemplate further formalization does not preclude the existence of a present intention to be obligated to perform the agreement as it is made. And the consideration of the facts and surrounding circumstances, the course of dealings of the parties, and the conduct of the parties, their objective manifestations, is the focal point for that inquiry. And all of that evidence was presented to the jury. The questions that were asked to the jury were with regards to whether or not this agreement existed and whether or not it was breached and repudiated, of which there is no question. There has never been any argument made by the other side that there wasn't a repudiation of whatever the legal effect of the agreement of October 19, 1983 was.
If you contend and the other party contends that the contract was not ambiguous on its face, what was the reason for submitting the issue to the jury?
The reason for submitting the issue to the jury, Your Honor, was again not because the question was one of construction of the instrument, but as to whether or not the intent of the parties was to be legally bound to the instrument as or to the contractual terms of October 19th. Regardless of whether or not there had been time, as there had not been sufficient time, to formalize that into a later document. This is the question of the submission of the intent of the parties. And that's the question that is a fact question as identified by the code as to the formation of the contract. We're not talking about this being a construction of the contract issue or an interpretation of the contract. It predates that. It is the question of the party's intent to be bound as of that time. And that is a seminal fact question with regards to this issue. We're not suggesting that construction of the contract once the determination the contract exists, is not a proper focal point of inquiry for the court. It is. We agree with that.
This is an identical question to Texaco, right?
It is identical to the question that was answered adversely to Texaco by the Court of Appeals. And, of course, it was our position before this court that there was no fact question in that case, or that at least there was some great controversy about there being a fact question in that case.
Do I understand you to say that you're now perhaps saying that there was some credibility in the Court of Appeals' opinion that the intent of the parties to be bound? Texaco Pennzoil.
Judge, do I assume that that these remarks will not be forwarded to New York? In response to that, Your Honor, to be perfectly frank, I believe that there is a distinction, even in the position that I take here, for this reason. The arguments and cases utilized by Pennzoil in the Court of Appeals did, in fact, key all of a UCC analysis. Our position in Texaco at that time was simply that the UCC analysis was not applicable to a humongous multi-billion dollar buyout transaction. There's no question that the UCC wasn't applicable. If the UCC had been applicable to that type of transaction, that is, suppose it were a purchase of assets situation or some other kind of circumstance rather than the complicated situation that it was, frankly, I would not have subscribed to the argument that there was any argument to be made in that case, that there was a fact question. Clearly there's a fact question as to intent to be bound without regard to further formalization. But the UCC overlay makes it absolutely clear. In other words, this is a much stronger case than that was presented to the Court of Appeals in Pennzoil because of the UCC overlay. The UCC makes it very clear that the question involves an examination of the surrounding circumstances, the conduct of the parties, and the analysis of the subject matter of the transaction is always something that is subject to proof, not to vary the terms of any instrument, but to show what the nature of the negotiations is and to see, in the objective sense, Corbynesque sense, as to whether or not there is an intent to be bound, whether there is a meeting of the minds, whether there has been all of the material terms. There is no question here that there is nothing indefinite about this contractual arrangement in October of 1983. All of the terms of delivery, the terms of sale, the terms of financing, all of those had been negotiated, completed, and were there. There is absolutely nothing left open for the future negotiations. And unlike the arguments in Texaco that were made, well, there were many things that were unresolved. There really isn't anything unresolved. The only thing that the court seized upon was a Section 4 of the listing, which merely says subject to legal documentation and UCC financing formalities, which were all necessary for purposes of ultimate consummation of the financing, which received tentative approval based on the October agreement itself. Immediate arrangements were made for that financing as a result of this transaction. Immediate arrangements were made with regards to the consummation of the purchase and delivery. And the reason they had to be immediate, as is testified to by all of the parties in this particular case, is because of the desire for very prompt delivery from Europe by February of the following year of these rather complex rides, amusement rides. Numerous negotiations in regards to the purchase of those were known to have to be conducted and were in the process of being conducted by our people, by Ferrer. And the financing of those particular arrangements were being undertaken immediately and had to be done so immediately. It is not a question of whether or not there wasn't an obligation to ultimately formalize as a part of the contractual obligation. And in fact, because if we had not done that at all, perhaps then we would be subject, and we don't have any real question, we would be subject to liability for breach of the agreement on our side. And they would have a right to sue us based on our failure to even procure the formalization. That is an obligation. On the other hand, it is interesting to note that in the agreement itself, and to show that there is a present intention to be bound to that agreement, from the minute that agreement is signed, the agreement provides in the latter portions, and this is the one that is initialed by both parties, signed writing, and what it says is that the legal expenses, and legal expenses refer to the formalization of the document, etc., shall be borne by GRD.
Let me interrupt.
So that, yes, sir.
This UCC overlay you mentioned a moment ago, I've hurriedly reviewed again the Court of Appeals opinion. There's no mention of any UCC provision in the Court of Appeals opinion. What provision are you talking about that you say is controlling here?
Well, Your Honor, one of the provisions is the Texas Business Commerce Code 2.201. We refer to it in our application for writ. There are numerous provisions of the UCC that were relied upon during the trial of the case. In proof and in fact, our briefing is rather replete in the Court of Appeals with the UCC analysis. We did find it fairly interesting that it was totally ignored by the El Paso Court of Appeals, but which is something that I thought was of rather considerable significance. And I cannot explain exactly why the court decided to disregard it, other than the fact it was inconvenient to the result that was achieved. And other than that, I really cannot see why that was disregarded. There's no question the transcript is replete. In fact, the trial brief with regards to the charge that was submitted to the trial court has specific references to the UCC provisions that were justified and warranted the instructions that accompanied the charge and the submission of the special issues. There is no question that from beginning to end that this was tried as a UCC case, and one that was controlled by the UCC, and therefore has a much broader perspective in terms of formulating the contractual intent to be bound, and that being in large measure a fact question for the jury. When you have an instrument that is capable of being enforced and a remedy being supplied, which is part of the essence of the argument that was in fact made in Pennzoil, was could a remedy be fashioned and could the agreement be mutually enforced? And the answer on the face of this agreement in this case is clearly yes, it can. And the remedy was supplied by the jury, and there is no issue as to what the net profits lost as a result of the repudiation was. Now, the Court of Appeals, for that matter, is another interesting anomaly. In a further effort to bootstrap its position, suggests, well, the initial draft, which was actually not ever tendered or seen by GRD because they repudiated prior to its consummation, that the initial draft contained some provisions that were in some manner inconsistent or at least not having been discussed in the October 19th letter, which is an interesting bootstrap argument because the whole position is that agreement was not executed, and therefore there's no reason for the El Paso court whatsoever to have referred to some deviations as a result of the preparing of the formalized document, since their whole position was the absence of it meant as a matter of law there's no jury issue. And the point is that the court actually misstates, the El Paso court misstates very clearly the applicable law in Texas anyway, which is in regards to the condition precedent, where the court says that if there's any evidence that it's a condition precedent, if there's any way to make it a condition precedent, we'll make it one. And the law in this state is to the contrary. That is, that you construe against conditions precedent, and not that you elevate them into a high priority item, which is in essence what the Court of Appeals said. And our position, for that matter, in the application on the statement of jurisdiction is that directly conflicts with this court's opinion in the Schwartz-Jordan case, which says that you construe an agreement not to provide a condition precedent. But even so, those are condition precedents to performance and not conditions precedent to the formation of the agreement. And the court missed the boat altogether because what I was attempting to allude to a minute ago, the provision in the contract itself, in the October 19th memorandum, which is a culmination of a series of negotiations beginning in early September, not only is definitely enforceable and contains every single term that needs to be in the document for purposes of the buy-sell, does provide subject to legal documentation. It's not even a complete sentence, of course. It's merely a notation as to what it is. But then in the next paragraph provides that the legal expenses are to be paid by the other side, which means that immediately upon the outset of forever, with Foreman Dice to commence the preparation of the formal documents, under the agreement that was signed in October, those expenses were to be borne and to be paid by GRD. so that the performance that immediately consummated was contemplated. The legal expenses that are being talked about in that agreement means that it was intended that that agreement was to go forward and to be performed immediately and created legal obligations of the parties at that time. In fact, that is reinforced in the record in terms of the factual context by the testimony of Mr. Dipp himself, who, when he placed his order for the amusement rides, ultimately, with another firm, similarly entered into an agreement which also said that it was subject to legal documentation and took the position on the stand that he was bound as of that time, although there were other things to be done that later on that maybe he could get out of. Maybe there would be excuses of performance later on, but he considered himself bound legally to the contract and had a contract that was formed as of that time, which is obviously diametrically opposed to the position that is asserted in this lawsuit. And it's the jury that heard that information. And certainly the jury was entitled to conclude, based on all of the surrounding circumstances, that there was an enforceable agreement. In fact, there are no points of error that attack the jury's findings for either legal or factual insufficiency. The only point is an argument that the subject to means that as a matter of law, factual inquiry is foreclosed. And in a UCC context, that is simply not the state of the law in this state. It is not consistent with the UCC provisions. The question of the intent to be bound in contract formation cases is a seminal question of fact. The jury had the evidence before it, properly answered the questions. Those are not challenged. The damages are not challenged. And we would submit that the judgment of the trial court should be affirmed.
May it please the court, my name is David Anderson, appearing along with Mr. McMaines on behalf of the petitioner in this case. I would like to touch on two arguments and address them together because I think they dovetail. The first argument is that the party's intent was a fact question for the jury. It was a fact question that was properly submitted to and decided by the jury. The second argument is that the contract language or the subject to language in the contract document does not establish as a matter of law that there were conditions, that was a condition preceding or condition precedent. In fact, a more logical reading of that contract militates in the other direction, that it wasn't a condition at all, that it was simply an agreement, a term, a covenant, an agreement that later on this document would be formalized and there would be many documents prepared, those would be executed. The evidence showed at trial that the parties met in October of 1983 to discuss the sale of these six amusement park rides. Now, at that meeting, Mr. Dipp, the president of GRD Development Company, explained that he was opening a new amusement park there in El Paso, that it was scheduled to open in the spring of 1984, and that he needed these rides by February of 1984 so they could be erected and be operational by the time that he opened his park. Mr. Paulison said, well, that's fine. The rides can be delivered by February 15th of 1984. But if we're going to deliver the rides that early, we have to have an immediate commitment. Because at that time, the seller had to do three things. The seller had to acquire the rides. The seller didn't even own the rides in October of 1983. The rides had to be acquired in Europe. They had to arrange for shipping from Europe to the United States and ultimately to El Paso. And the seller had to arrange for the financing. So Mr. Paulison made it very clear, and the record shows, he made it very clear that if the rides were going to be delivered in February and were going to be operational in Mr. Dipp's park by March or by the spring of 1984, then he had to have an immediate commitment so that he could go back to Europe and begin performance. And the testimony, Mr. Pullison's testimony, the trial was, Mr. Dipp said, we have a deal. Let's sign it up. And they sat down and prepared what is the October 19, 1983 handwritten memorandum. And they wrote it out on a piece of stationery. And when they finished, Mr. Dipp took that document and he made two Xerox copies of it. One Xerox copy was signed by Mr. Paulison and given to Mr. Dipp to keep. One Xerox copy was signed by Mr. Dipp and given to Mr. Paulison to keep. And after that, Mr. Paulison went back to Europe and he bought the rides, he arranged for shipping, and he arranged for the financing. Now, the respondent takes the position that because there is a provision in that document that says, excuse me.
You lost me there. Who arranged the financing? You said authorized maintenance and arranged financing?
Yes, sir.
The seller
bought the rides, arranged for the shipping, and arranged for the financing.
I thought the financing was going to be done in El Paso by the buyer.
No, sir. The financing was being done through a European company, a European financing company out of Switzerland. And that was arranged, although not done, but it was arranged by the seller. Okay. The respondent takes the position that because there is this subject to legal documentation language in the contract, that vitiates the entire document, that the parties did not intend to be bound. Well, that was the very issue that was submitted to the jury. Now, the argument that this created a condition precedent, it doesn't make sense factually, it doesn't make sense logically, and it's not consistent with the law. What the El Paso Court of Appeals said is a provision, talking about this provision 4, subject to legal documentation. El Paso Court of Appeals says a provision in a contract creates a condition in the absence of anything in the contract to show that such was not the intention of the parties. Well, the rule of law is just the opposite. The rule that this court enunciated in the Schwartz-Jordan case is that it is a rule of construction that a forfeiture by finding a condition precedent is to be avoided when possible under another reasonable reading of the contract. So, first of all, the Court of Appeals applied the wrong standard. Secondly, what the Court of Appeals in essence held was that, since it found that there was a condition precedent, implicit in that is that there was an agreement. There was an agreement in place, but it was conditioned on the performance of some future event. Well, the future event that they're talking about is the subsequent execution of agreement. So when you boil it down, what the Court of Appeals is saying is there was an agreement that was conditioned on them agreeing to the same thing at a later time. And that just doesn't make sense. It is easy to understand a situation where parties would sit down and discuss a deal. And one party might say, we don't have an agreement. We are interested. We want you to have your lawyers prepare up some documents, and we'll look at them, and we anticipate signing them. But we don't have an agreement. But it is very difficult to understand a situation where the parties would sit down and say, we have an agreement, but this agreement is conditioned on us agreeing to the same thing sometime later. Thank you. That's all I have.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. We're now ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please support Mr. Jerry Shook? I will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. I'd like to, if I may, just put things in context. In September the 2nd, 1983, the petitioner wrote a letter to GRD. And in that letter, the petitioner set out the rules. This is Plaintiff's Exhibit 1. He says, this offer to sell you these rides is subject to legal documentation, finance. That was the first condition. My client accepted those terms. Later on, they arranged to meet in El Paso. He flew over from Belgium, Mr. Poulsen, and they executed a memorandum agreement prepared by Mr. Poulsen, by his own admission, that said, provision 4, among others, subject to, what was subject to? The deal. Subject to legal documentation. But it wasn't left there. Subject to legal documentation, contract to be prepared by Mr. Dunlap, naming the law firm in Houston. The law firm that was the representative of Ferreca. Now, that was one of the clear terms of the agreement. The petitioner's argument before the court does away with all of the basic law of contract interpretation. The law of contract interpretation, as enunciated by this court in Coker and in many other cases, is that the courts do not make agreements for the parties. These parties made an agreement. Part of the agreement had a condition that the deal was subject to a contract to be created by the plaintiff's lawyer.
Is it your position that the word subject to will always create a condition precedent?
My position is that those words are unambiguous and clear. And in this case, those words are acknowledged to be unambiguous. You heard my opponent state that this contract is not ambiguous. So if something is subject to, and in this court, Hornburg was one of the decisions, and another one cited in our brief, United General, has already ruled that these are words of condition, not covenants. So in this case, they are words of condition.
Your cases say those words of condition are binding on the finder of fact?
The cases say that you look first for the intent of the parties in the contract. And if the contract has express words that are unambiguous, it then becomes a matter of law for the court, and there's no issue to submit to the jury.
I'm sorry, I may not be asking my question right.
Did the cases say
that the word subject to, reducing it to writing, always create a condition?
Or is it
up to the intention of the parties?
The basic thing is always intention of the parties. But the cases have ruled on synonyms and words like subject to that those are words of condition. They say these are words of condition. I imagine that there are cases like Texaco and Schwartz-Jordan where the parties tried to add subject to language that was not in the agreement and failed. And that's a distinguishing feature.
What about the provision that it'd be effective upon the posting of an escrow bond or escrow payment?
That would be unambiguous. It would be effective upon a certain happening, and that would be a condition.
I wrote an opinion for this court about 5 years ago versus Wakefield, and there we said that it was not a condition preceding, but rather was a penalty.
As I recall, in that case, there was no express conditioning language, and I may have said effective, but our case I distinguish because it says subject to. Those words cannot be disregarded. Counsel and the trial court elected to disregard provision 4 and behave as if those words were not there. We feel that the petitioner in this case sued on that particular handwritten memo. My client agreed to provision 4 as well as the other provision. Provision 4 that we agreed to said that this deal is subject to a contract. Now, if we had tried to do as they did in Texaco, have a press release after we had cut the deal and say, this is subject to, then I could understand that there's a fact dispute that needs to be submitted to the jury. But it's so clear that first you look for the intent of the parties in the agreement. You don't disregard one provision in favor of another.
You're saying the issue of the parties' intent to be bound should never have been submitted to the jury.
Exactly. And
what
then,
objections did you make to the issue?
That very thing, that there was a condition proceeding that was by admission disregarded, and that the agreement by admission was not ambiguous, and that this is a matter of law for the court. I may have articulated it better here than I did in the record, but...
It usually is that way.
Under the pressure of the jury waiting, I did my best. We did, contrary to counsel's earlier remark, make objection by point of error to legal and factual insufficiencies. And if I may just very quickly address another point that counsel raised in the UCC. We contend, and I think it's very clear, that where the express language of the parties covers something, that controls over the UCC. Section 1.102C, 1.103, all of these are in our appellant's brief that we brought forward, 1.205B and 2.208B also. UCC, yes. But if the language of the parties says otherwise, then we follow the language of the parties. In our appellant's brief, we cited a Fifth Circuit case called John P. Chemical, exactly as in this case. And the court in the Fifth Circuit, citing the Texas Supreme Court, says that where there is express language, it controls over the UCC. This is exactly our situation here. Every time someone like in Schwartz, Georgia, tries to engraft a condition that's not in the basic agreement, the appellate courts say they failed. They failed in Texaco. They failed in Schwartz, Georgia. But where it's in the agreement, it's set and says subject to, then that's our situation. We have a further compounding thing. I hate to throw more fire here when the court's about ready for vacation, but here's a situation where the plaintiff petitioner sues on an agreement that has this wording in it that it's subject to a contract to be drawn by a specific party.
It didn't say that, counsel. It says subject to legal documentation.
Legal documentation.
To contract.
That's true.
So you're extending out. You're hurting yourself with me when you're over.
It does say legal documentation. But if I can leap a step further, and I think the court will see telexes from Poulsen, the petitioner. Those telexes went to Mr. Dunlap, his lawyer. Also, in the exhibits, the court will see a telex to the Belgian attorney. Those telexes call for contracts to be drawn, not just documentation, not just UCC forms.
Why can that not be formalization of an agreement that has already been entered in writing by your client and the other party?
Well, because I have to go back again to the fact that there are subject to words here. This subject to is not a mysterious thing. It occurs in many real estate contracts. They say subject to financing. This one said subject to financing also. You can subject an examination of a piece of land to survey or to zoning. And until those things take place, you haven't got a deal. It's a condition that must be satisfied first.
What are all the subject to provisions in this handwritten memorandum? One is legal documentation. You say a second is financing?
A second is financing, and there is another factor that has not been addressed that we raised in the Court of Appeal and by proper motions along the way, that there are omitted material facts, omitted material conditions, rather, to the contract. And one of them was this. Mr. Poulsen testified that he could not make the deal without guarantees by PDIP and GeorgeDIP, or GDIP, I'm sorry. The agreement says G and PDIP, guarantors to pro notes. By agreement, we understand that to mean promissory notes. GeorgeDIP initialed GD, or some form of initial, on the handwritten memo. Paul Dip never did. The testimony from George was, I do not want to be bound as a guarantor unless my brother was going to guarantee with me. Paul Dip says, I wasn't going to guarantee anything until we saw the contract to which this deal was subject to. We submitted issues. Were there omitted material situations? The judge denied those issues. That, too, would have prevented it. Why? Because the plaintiff or petitioner himself says that without it, I couldn't have made the deal. They were material. He said so in so many words. He said some other things, and if I may, in our reply brief in the Court of Appeals, which we brought up, we mentioned that there were testimonial admissions from the petitioner that clearly indicated, and the Court of Appeals saw this and said that all of these facts created an undisputed situation where there were unsatisfied, unfulfilled, and totally disregarded conditions preceding. I thought I was hollering in the desert when I said to the trial judge, Judge, what? We can't ignore these. It isn't here by their own admission. Finally, the Court of Appeals saw that, and they said, look, this plaintiff sued on a contract. The contract had words of condition in it. The plaintiff had a burden under American Teachers versus Burgett, decided by this court, where there were conditions preceding, to get a finding. But first they had to plead that the defendant waived those conditions or were estopped to assert the conditions. They never pled it. They just disregarded it. Now, the contract had these words in it. If we're going to interpret the contract and ignore Provision 4, then we lose. If we interpret the contract and read words that by the petitioner's admissions are not ambiguous, well, what do they mean? Well, we look at the facts and circumstances. Mr. Poulison said, in his September 2nd letter, he said that the deal was, in effect, and I'll paraphrase, subject to satisfactory legal documentation and financing, I believe is the way it was worded. I asked him at trial, what does the word satisfactory mean? Satisfactory to whom, sir? And he says, satisfactory to Faraka. He says, on page 212 to 214 of the statement of facts, he says that if it was our rule of the house, it was our satisfaction that had to be. So I said, well, sir, suppose Mr. Dipp of GRD was not satisfied. What was his remedy after you presented the legal documentation or contracts? And he said, he protects himself if he doesn't agree by not signing it. That's how he protects himself, by not signing. Well, there is a clear, unequivocal statement, a testimonial admission, that there was no deal until it was signed.
Isn't this an identical argument you make to the jury where you say we did not intend to be bound, and the other side said, yes, you did intend to be bound? Why is that not a fact issue that was resolved against you by the jury?
It's not a fact issue. Again, I go back to my old theme that if, under proper contract interpretation, the court, as a matter of law, looks at unambiguous language, and if the court says this is not ambiguous, then the court interprets the contract and the jury doesn't get a chance to.
We're not talking about interpretation of the contract. Why? We obviously, you characterize the issue one way and McBank and his side characterize another way. What is your best argument that this is not an issue as to whether or not the parties intended to be bound?
Because
that's the way the other side characterizes the issue. What is your best argument against that?
Well, because of the plain wording of the agreement, that they said that the plaintiff or the petitioner says we don't want to be bound. It's one of the rules of our house in his letter, the letter we accepted, and in the memorandum it was perpetuated that we don't want to be bound. It's subject to. If it's subject to doesn't mean that the entire transaction is subject to something, what does it mean? I mean, those words cannot be disregarded, and if the plaintiff or petitioner had come in here and said, this agreement does not mean subject to, it's ambiguous. That's what they're saying. They're saying it's ambiguous. They're arguing it's ambiguous when they say we're not arguing that it's ambiguous. But they are. That's exactly what they're doing. They're saying we're going to discover the intent of this agreement from outside of the four corners of the agreement. Well, you only do that where it's ambiguous.
What was the legal documentation contemplated, subject to legal documentation?
I can give you what the testimony was.
That, well, let me hear that.
The defendant, GRD, had been contracting with a company called Arrowhus, and they had boxes of contracts drawn by various New York lawyers that were submitted to a lawyer named Skip Scoggins that represented GRD in this transaction. And the defendant testified that he contemplated all of these other provisions and things be resolved before he would be bound. In other words, delivery, inspection, when it came in at Houston or Galveston, I forgot now where it went. There were so many factors to be considered that if you look at the draft that never got to the either of the parties, petitioner never saw the draft and the legal documentation until we developed it during pretrial discovery. But if you look at it, you'll see that they gave my client, I think, 48 hours to inspect $2 million worth of complicated amusement park rides that would have taken them about 3 weeks to inspect. There were a number of other factors. Waiver of the DTPA was thrown in. We had never discussed that. Many, many factors, and they're all in the exhibits developed. Going back to the telexes as to what was to be put in, one of the required things was that Mr. Poulison testified, Faraka testified, yes, I understood that Skip Scoggins was going to be the lawyer that would examine and approve the contracts, talking about contracts. And so I said, well, where did you get Skip Scoggins' name? And he said, I got it from GRD. Well, what did he tell you? He said, well, he's the lawyer. And I said, well, let's look at your telex and see what you told Dunlap, your lawyer. And sure enough, right there in the telex, he says, Skip Scoggins, his name and address, and so on, and says that's where it was to be sent. Well, that fits with what my client said. He says, I wasn't going to be bound until my lawyer had seen it. Paul Depp had a lawyer in the Grambling law firm in El Paso. And he says, I wasn't going to sign it. I wasn't going to guarantee it until that lawyer had seen it.
Did you make these same arguments to the jury?
As best I could, with no issue to back me up. The issue submitted was, did the parties have an agreement to buy 6 amusement park rides? And I said, Judge, let's submit, did the parties intend, just the same thing Mr. McMahon said, should have been submitted, did the parties intend by this agreement to be bound or not? Let's find out. If they intended to be bound, fine.
You sense an agreement between whether or not there's an agreement that they intended to be bound by and whether or not they agreed? You think there's a difference?
Well, I think that the issue whether they intended by this particular agreement to be bound then and there, I was fighting with my back to the wall. We had to go with the issue that we had, and I felt like, yes, whether that was the ultimate intent was the ultimate issue. And so whether the October handwritten memo was intended to be binding was it. That was the ultimate issue, the controlling issue. If the court said, did they have an agreement about 6 amusement park rides, that issue would not have flown in Island Recreation versus Republic or any other case, because it didn't say, did they waive provision 4? We asked the court that. Did they waive provision 4? Were they a stop? The plaintiff or petitioner never contended that that provision was ever waived. Never contended we were stopped by our conduct to assert it. Their pleading...
Counsel, why was that not under Island Recreation subsumed in the issue that required whether or not the handwritten document, which was initialed by the parties, constituted by a fell agreement?
Because you can't waiver and estoppel are not subsumed in an agreement. In the Island case, they asked, was there performance of all? And in our case, if we could have had that issue, as broad as it is, and as criticized as it has been, if we could have just said, was all performed, we could have argued, well, look, they didn't get the contract. They didn't submit it. But the judge, suppose in Island, instead of asking, had it been all performed, they had merely said this. Did Island have an agreement with Republic to do financing for it? Well, that would have been such an extension of Island that you would have never decided in favor of Island in the majority opinion at all, because that would carry it a step further. But Island says, and supports us 100%, Island says that there has to be waiver or estoppel of these conditions pled, and in Island's case, they pled. And the court says they pled it, so we don't have that before us anymore since Island pled waiver and estoppel. Then Island went ahead and proved that the Republic employees continued to work on the applications about the financing. In Fereca, they didn't plead it. They never said that we waived it or estopped or anything to excuse it. What they did was they disregarded it. They disregarded Provision 4. They said, yeah, we got an agreement, but they disregarded that part of the agreement is provision 4.
Well, what did the petitioners do to show they were performing the contract?
All they did was use this time thing. They said, oh, we had to perform fast because it was in February. Bear in mind, petitioner is I don't know if this is exactly accurate, but a ride broker, amusement ride broker. They didn't have any rides, but they had, even before they wrote the letter of September 2nd, investigated and found rides that they thought we would be interested in because of an earlier contact from one of their representatives, say Mr. Cooley. So they knew that they could get these rides. So that was part of their obligation. They had arranged, according to their trial testimony, a number of the rides, but when my client told them, because of the unusual circumstances in New Orleans and Louisiana, when we did not get the contracts or documentation that we thought the deal was subject to, we went to New Orleans to get them and pick them up from Mr. Poulsen, who was to get them from Houston. Testimony is, the Houston lawyer sent them to the Marriott. Poulsen checked out of the Marriott, never got them, and never saw them until shortly before trial. And when he did see them, he said they would not have been satisfactory to me, much less Mr. Dent. He has too much things in there that we never discussed.
Did you hear that?